we'll be dropping a 3-hour block of old school beats from back in the day. Again, tune in just before midnight on Thursday, November 17th for a celebration of Hip Hop History Month right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Stepping Outside Polite Conversation Evening with the Tar Sands Valve Turners, Wednesday, November 16th at 7 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House in Portland. Hear 5 of the Tar Sands Valve Turners share stories of their nonviolent direct actions that took place October 11th and hear about why they took this form of climate activism. Again, that's Stepping Outside Polite Conversation, an evening with the Tar Sands Valve Turners on Wednesday, November 16th at 7 p.m. at the Sunnyside Community House, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S.-made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
You can say that it's about the savages. You can say you have a better way to live. You can call it manifest destiny. You can talk of all your civilization will give. You can say that we're a thing of history, and progress is the future you will bring. You can send your armies to these mountains. You can say we'll prosper beneath your king. But there will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose. Stop the communists. You can say that our ideals can't succeed. You can say that competition is the only way, and a global system based on greed. You can call yourself a Democrat. You can call yourself whatever you will. You can keep on stamping out the fires you start, so you might stay on top of the hill. There will always be resistance. The next battle will always be near. As long as you have everything, there will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose. Say that all of us are terrorists, madmen bent on destroying all that's free. You can say that we are building weapons as your bombers fly from sea to bloody sea. You can say you're with us or against us, and to die quietly is what we now must do. You can maintain your innocence. You can say that you are many as you represent the few. There will always be resistance. The next battle will always be. 'cause our future is not yours to choose.
And good morning. Welcome once again to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. I am your host, Paul Rowland, and I will be with you until 9 o'clock. And we are talking about resistance. We can turn that down there, Liam. Thank you very much. Anyway, Portland's Resistance, a new political movement in town. We will be having, hopefully they will arrive here. They said they're, stuck in traffic. Guests Gregory McKelvey and Kat Stevens will talk about the recent demonstrations against Trump triumphant and the birth of a new group in town, Portland's Resistance. I'll introduce that when they get here. First up, however, from out in, I believe, Hood River, we've got Leonard Higgins online, one of the you just heard the station spot there for the event tonight, the Tar Sands Valve Turners, Stepping Outside Polite Conversation, five Pacific Northwest activists turn off the flow of Alberta tar sands oil, and they will tell their stories this evening to the local audience, and that will be at Sunnyside Community House, 363520 Southeast Yamhill, at doors open 6:30, program at 7, and I believe they might be trying to help out with their legal issues there. Leonard, good morning. Is Leonard, did he disappear? Something wrong with the box?
Good morning. Good morning, Paul. I was muted there. I'm sorry. Thank you for having me on the show.
So I see here, I could let you say it yourself, but you got a couple neat paragraphs describing yourselves. You're retired from a 31-year career with Oregon State Government, focused on budget, contracts, and project management. For large information technology projects, you credit your awakening about social justice and climate change threats to a 2007 workshop from Joanna Macy in her book, Active Hope. And it goes on, you were a co-founder of Corvallis Chapter of 350.org in 2012, and been an organizer and participant in many social and climate justice efforts since then. And you did your first direct action in 2013 in blocking transport through Oregon of tar sands extraction. Oh, that was the tar sands blockade. You were involved in that.
Right, the megaloads.
The megaloads.
That's right. Yeah, I'm a Johnny-come-lately to activism, a pretty unlikely person to be out there locking down to try to stop fossil fuel infrastructure, but it's the responsible thing to do now.
So you took a quantum, you've taken a quantum curve here, so to speak, not just a quantum leap, but through... since your retirement, then you did an action that could you land you in some serious, potentially serious prison time. I don't know exactly what your lawyers are telling you, but talk about what brought you to that, the latest action of it doesn't sound as dramatic as it might sound by the prosecution. You basically just, turned off a valve.
Yes, there was a lot of work into turning off the valves in the four states. On October 11th, in prayer and solidarity with the Standing Rock Sioux, we shut down all five pipelines carrying tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada to the U.S. And so in 15-minute intervals, starting in Minnesota and then North Dakota, Montana, and finally Washington, we called the pipeline companies twice, once from our communications center and once at each of the block valve sites, to let them know that we would be closing the emergency valves. And then in an hour, we had gone from east to west to Washington and shut down all five lines.
That's pretty dramatic. So Obviously, there must have been a certain amount of recon research involved. And also, I understand there's some dangers in shutting down these pipelines. You have to do it in a very careful way. Is that right?
We were very careful. We researched the safety procedures. We did several months of scouting and research. We chose valves that were at least 10 miles from pumping stations. Yes, the last thing we wanted was to create any kind of problem, oil leakage, by our action. But these are emergency valves that are meant to be used whenever there's a need to stop the flow of oil. And we also coordinated with the pipeline companies by calling them ahead of time. And actually in Minnesota, the pipeline company remotely shut down the lines before Emily and Annette could begin closing the manual valves. So we were very careful in the action, but also very clear that not only do we need to stop new infrastructure for fossil fuel usage, but we have to begin ramping down on what we're using now. James Hansen's plan, if we would have started several years ago, we could have started a more gradual decline in usage, maybe, 6% per year, but we're up in the 8 or 9% now. In fact, when we shut down those tar sands lines, that's approximately 15% of the U.S. consumption of just oil, not even counting coal and natural gas. And that's about enough to meet that ramp down of usage for this year if we could have kept those valves closed.
Mm-hmm. So you said these are emergency valves, so obviously you see this as an emergency situation, time to shut those down.
Very much so.
Go ahead.
As a father and a grandfather and a responsible member of my community, I don't have any other choice at this point. The prospect of spending time in prison is minor compared to what we're facing. I've said in several places now to people that we've been talking to that the reason I think that people don't see this as an emergency is they don't see the government. They don't see their community members acting as if this is an emergency. And so I think all of us that know the threat that we're facing need to act as though we have that emergency facing us. And that's the responsible thing to do.
So what kind of charges are you facing? And I assume you've just gone through the preliminary. Talk about if you want to your legal strategy and with the current charges, what are the maximum possible sentences?
So they range pretty broadly in the four states. Mine actually are the most minor. I'm looking at a felony charge that could give me 10 years in prison. The most severe charges are for Michael in North Dakota, and they total 83 years. Ken in Washington, 35 years. Emily and Annette in Minnesota, I believe they're looking at something like 25 years if they had to serve the maximum sentence for the charges.
So can you talk about your legal approach? Will you be pleading? Will you be taking this to court and trying to fight them all the way?
Yes. The necessity defense is a defense that is the least harm. It's a situation where, like if you see a child in a neighbor's house trapped and there's a fire, there's no way that you would not break into the house and rescue that child for fear of being prosecuted for breaking and entering. This is a situation where we're doing our best to protect our children and our communities, and so that's the case we'll be making in court. The plan to spend perhaps a year in talking to communities and working our way into jury trials and presenting the necessity defense is part of this plan that we had from the beginning. After we closed the valves, we each waited in block valve enclosures for as much as an hour and a half waiting for sheriffs to arrest us.
And you're listening to Leonard Higgins here on a Wednesday talk radio. He's going to be with the other four tar sands valve turners tonight at a public presentation at the Sunnyside Community House, 3520 Southeast Yamhill Street, starts at 7. The show is mainly going to be devoted to the Portland's Resistance, a new group that sprung up in reaction to the Trump election and is trying to grow into a actual organized political movement. Our guests are hopefully on the way, but until they get here, we'll just continue talking with Leonard. And so you gave a presentation, y'all gave a presentation. So obviously you guys are all out since you're doing these public presentations. What kind of bail did they make you all pay?
The bail ran from $50,000 for me in Montana to as much as $75,000 for Ken in Washington. Really shocking thing about the way it played out in the arrest is that they not only arrested those of us that carefully considered the risk we were taking in terms of prison terms, and but also they arrested the journalists and the support people that were not trespassing. They even confiscated the video material of the journalists that were involved, the documentarians. And it's just like Amy Goodman's arrest at Standing Rock. There's such a repressive atmosphere right now. I'm looking forward to hearing more from your guests, Gregory and Kat, about Portland Resistance. I so agree with them that peaceful assembly and protest is a huge part of and a necessary part of our democracy.
It looks like they have just arrived, as you spoke, or at least one of them. And so Leonard, as we introduce Gregory here in a second, where are things going? You guys are doing a tour like around the country. When does the trial start? I guess they're all four or five different trials, or even more maybe, because there's also the support people. How's this going to play out?
One more time quickly, just a reminder to your listeners that we will be at the Sunnyside Community House. Doors open at 6:30, and the program starts at 7. There'll be a guitarist, Wes Kempfer, that will be performing before the event starts at 7. Now I've forgotten what you asked me, Paul.
Oh, just when when do you expect the trials to start? And touring until then, or?
So Ken's trial, you're right. There are four different county jurisdictions in the four states. My arraignment is on December 6th in Fort Benton, Montana. Ken's trial in Washington may start as soon as January 7th. The schedules, we'll be posting those on the website. The website is shutitdown.today. And there's also a Facebook page, Shut It Down Climate Direct Action. And so we'll be posting those trial dates there. And we're really looking forward to talking to the folks that attend this evening and describing the action in more detail, and really looking forward to questions and conversation with those that attend about where we go from here.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Leonard, for calling in from Hood River, and people can see you this evening. I'll mention that towards the end of the show. Leonard Higgins talking about the tar sands valve turning action that is for which they are facing potentially many years in prison. We'll probably see you later.
Thanks very much, Paul.
Okay. And with that, let me just a quick announcement for another event this evening. Dispatch from the Front Lines, Oregon's Patriot Movement, the acquittal of the Bundy Bunch, and discussion in connection to Standing Rock, Black Lives Matter, and the overall quest for social justice. The recent acquittal of seven of the occupiers of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge has shaken many rural communities across Oregon who have been frontline to the violence and intimidation posed by militias. Join us for a presentation by the Rural Organizing Project on what the Patriot Movement looks like in Oregon and across the country. We will learn the political and economic roots of the Patriot Movement, how Patriot groups and paramilitaries recruit, and the disruption Patriot groups have caused in communities across the state, including Harney, Grant, Josephine, Crook, and Baker counties in Oregon. We'll discuss these developments in context with current events at Standing Rock and Black Lives Matter movements across the country. There'll be a panel of organizers. And for more information, contact Kara at the Rural Organizing Project, Kara at ROP.org or 503-438-8638. Child care is available, many co-sponsors. And with that, good morning, Gregory.
Good morning.
You're on KBOO again. I heard you last evening.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm getting used to this room.
Well, this is probably some crossover. Of course, different times, different audiences, different shows, different audiences. We're really glad to have you here. I just want to kind of put a little context as I wrote up for this thing on the KBOO page for this show, Wednesday Talk Radio. As people across country erupted in largely spontaneous mass demonstrations after the presidential election, Portland garnered national and international media attention for the intensity of some of those protests. Though the well-publicized incidents of window smashing, my throat caught on that term there for some reason, were as usual often the center of that media attention. The protests were also noteworthy for the number of participants, the consistency of the demonstrations over several days, and by many accounts, the large number of new faces among the protesters. Youth are clearly the driving force behind the anti-Trump activism across the country. And in Portland, that appears to be at least partly due to a new organization, Portland's Resistance. The group, which called the rallies, adheres to a position of nonviolence and did not condone the property destruction that occurred several hours into Thursday night's protest march, and perhaps some other occasions you can talk about that. But of course, there are a diversity of opinions about the question of diversity of tactics that any grassroots movement that fights the power structure has to take into consideration. But more important, Portland's Resistance is trying to bring together the diverse strands of activism in the Portland area into a unified force for broad social change. I hope that's not projecting too much ambition onto your group. Time will tell if it can overcome traditional divisions and different divergent ideologies, approaches, and tactics. So that's a mouthful. So one of the organizers, and Kat Stevens was also going to be here. Do you think she'll show up?
I'm not sure. Okay. I hope so.
No worries. So Gregory McKelvey, you are one of the organizers. Just before, maybe just quickly respond, anything what I just read stand out to you? Is anything ring false, ring true?
No, that's pretty accurate. Yeah, Portland's Resistance is a new group that's our leadership makes up a bunch of people from other activist groups, people that have been working on different causes, and we're just advocating for nonviolent protests, but we do advocate for protests. And, you know, I don't think it's my job to censor anybody else's activism, so I just lead by example, and that's all I can do.
But, of course, you are left. Yesterday you seemed to be responding a lot to, you see, you're getting it from both sides. I listened to some of the show, getting it from both sides, both the radical and the whatever, the people who are horrified at seeing windows smashed. Most of us probably tend to be more somewhere in the middle there. But you have sort of been forced to respond on the mass media, to your own comrades. There's obviously when things like that happen, people get people's passions get aroused, and people's certainly conservatives outrage, certainly fodder for the AM talk show hosts, no doubt about that. I actually regret kind of having been listening. I usually try to tune in a little bit to them, but I'm sure Lars Larson has been.
I was on the Lars Larson show twice recently.
No way.
I love it.
Let's talk about that.
So that's what I listen to. I don't even listen to music in the car. I listen to conservative talk radio. It's just really entertaining to me. You know, my dad's a Republican. My grandma's a Republican. Those are the two of the three people that really raised me. So I feel like I kind of know how they think. And I also think that we have more common ground than people like to think. And I also like to think I'm somewhat likable. So, you know, when Lars starts yelling at me, I don't think it's that good of a look for him. So I enjoy it. I hope he has me back on.
Huh? Yeah, he does. I called into his show once, and that's pretty much they just basically steamroller over you. It's like there seems to be the fallback tactic that they employ it. As opposed to someone like me, for example.
It's funny because I actually did the Armstrong and Getty show yesterday also, which I think is part of the Blaze Network. But, you know, they don't tell you when they call, hey, this is Lars Larson's show, just so you know, I'm like super conservative or anything like that. So it's just like because I listen that I know what I'm walking into. But like, I'm sure they didn't think I knew. Like, I'm just a young black kid. So I think they thought out they were just going to be able to steamroll me. But I knew what I was getting into. I enjoy it. It's fun. I like trying to reach a wider audience. So
They probably have those archived too, like we do ours. I'd like to listen to that. Yeah. We could. Anyway, So a few of the threads that I've introduced here. I mean, talk again. You talked about it last night. I'm sure you're used to it now. Repeat, what some of the feedback, you've been getting about this. You guys, so obviously, you organized these rallies, and then they kind of, as marches, rallies can do, they kind of took a life of their own. You didn't have some... Some rallies, some marches have peacekeepers who, are their task is to try to, quote, police the march. So you didn't take that strategy.
So I feel like if we're going to protest against the state and the police also, that it doesn't make sense for us to try and step in and fill that same role. I also don't think that it makes sense if somebody is, beating a window out with a bat, the worst thing I could ever do is tell people, hey, go confront that person, because then I could actually have physical damage, which is obviously much worse than property damage. So yeah, I get it from both sides, but I think everybody has to understand there's, upwards of 600,000 people, and we're not just trying to appeal to only the activist class, And it is a privilege to be able to go out there at night. A lot of people have children or work in the morning and things like that. So we can't just appeal to the people that are willing to hit the streets if we want to have the city on our side. We have to make sure that we're sending a message that's inclusive to all.
So this is a talk show. I haven't given out the number yet. A lot of people do know the number. But if you'd like to call in and join in this discussion, it's 503-231-8187. This is going to sound probably really ridiculous, but I had this fantasy. Sometimes you think sometimes you're in a conversation with someone and they say something, and then you think only hours later, I should have said this. And I of course didn't participate in those marches, so this is even more further from the actual situation. But I had my fantasy was I see someone, because I don't know, just like smashing out the windshields of a Toyota dealership strikes me as not a particularly effective strategy. And then even worse, like private cars, when you don't even know whose car it is, that always struck me as just the most ridiculous asinine thing to do. I just don't get it. So my fantasy was I see someone with their baseball, I'd run, grab the bat, and split. I think that's acceptable. You could get hit
with that bat though.
Well, yeah, but you have to be, you know, you have to be like really.
Well, I'm not going to direct anybody to do that because then I'm responsible for, you know, I already
have people mad at me. I was just speaking for myself.
Cool. So why don't you come and grab someone's bat, but don't ask me to tell you to do it.
Fair enough. Fair enough. No, I guess I'm saying like, there's this issue, you know, I've been around this stuff for a long time, you know, black blocks and this and that, you know, it's sure. Like, there's always this back and forth, you know, strict nonviolence is property damage violence, you know, policing the crowd, you know, the Nazi peacekeepers, you know, all this stuff. Anyway, so, but to me, it's like the idea of actually confronting someone directly from the radical side or the people, the black bloc side, if you were, or the people who, you know, who see those as viable tactics, they're like even against you on your own principles, like confronting them, you know, saying, hey, that's a form of direct action. I don't see where you can draw the line on direct action. If you see something that you think is not right, you know, it gets really complicated. It gets messy. It's not so, nothing's really.
What I say is if somebody's doing something you don't like, you move away from them. I also think we have to be careful of blaming certain groups like Black Bloc and stuff, because I don't think that there was any organized group that was doing the vandalism. I just think it was individuals and vandals.
Right. I got to please continue after I say this. But yeah, I didn't mean to say that there was a quote Black Bloc. And I certainly never condemn Black Blocs. That could be a long discussion we don't need to get into. I was just sort of saying as a generic, that's like one example that my experience, that's all.
So when, I'll add that I think that Chase Bank had their windows smashed into, so it wasn't just dealerships. But every single inquiry we've gotten for the money that we've raised for people that, you know, had damages were completely supportive of us. You know, I think the businesses all had insurance, so they didn't really reach out to us. There were a couple small and local businesses, but mostly it was just individuals who had their cars just indiscriminately smashed, and they were like, "Hey, just so you know, we love Portland's resistance." So I agree that it might not be the best tactic, but there's a diversity of tactics. And I think if we're going to break down this system, you have to come at it from all angles. And so I think people understand what our angle is, and we understand what other people's angle is.
So before we get to our first caller, so you're raising money to reimburse some of the damage that's been done. How do people...
So there's a GoFundMe page that you can find on our Facebook or on our website, pdxresistance.org. And the idea was to help rebuild the city, and it took off. And now I think we're at around $56,000.
Oh, my God.
Which the claims don't come in that they don't have that much money in claims, like nearly. So we're going to make sure that money does go, though, into rebuilding Portland. And that's a discussion we're having with our leadership. But I do want to make sure that people understand no banks are getting any money, no major corporations, and no car dealerships. It's really the inquiries that we've been getting are from individuals who, you know, single mothers that have their car smashed out and they need to get a new car seat because there's glass all over it now in the back so they can keep their kids safe, that kind of stuff. But that money, every single cent will go into trying to rebuild Portland, but there's a lot of different ways to rebuild Portland, and there's a lot of groups that have been trying to rebuild Portland for a long time.
So let's go to our first caller, and after that, let's talk more about the actual origins of Portland's resistance and your background as an activist and some of the other organizers. But let's go to our first caller. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hello?
Hey, you guys, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, hey. I just wanted to let Greg know how much this city needs him and how much we support him. I'm a lifelong Portlander from Beaverton, and I just want to real quickly just thank him for all the work he's doing and say keep going.
All right.
Wow. I appreciate that because, man, I need to come here more often because the calls I get are death threats.
So, well, we got your back, Greg.
I appreciate it. That's amazing. That's the kind of stuff that keeps me going. You know, and I love hearing things like that. And I'm glad that our message is resonating with some people.
All right. Well, thank you for calling.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Well, let's just go right into our next caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. Who are you?
This is Joe. Hey, why aren't we protesting right down there on Pioneer Square in front of Channel 8? It's like we need to break through the media blackout on things like the black box voting. I don't think Donald Trump actually won the election. I think enough votes were electronically altered, and there is no paper trail. And I want to know how many states don't have any paper trails. It's like, why aren't we on Pioneer Square with a projector putting Greg Palast and Amy Goodman up on screen for all the public to see and do it day after day until Channel 8 takes notice? And the protest focus becomes, why isn't the media covering these things? The only way we're going to stop the Electoral College is if we have a huge public outcry about how this election was stolen. I think Greg Palast is somebody we ought to be having on the air 5 days a week. And like I say, putting it out in public Pioneer Square until Channel 8, you know, has to put something on the air. I think we ought to be, if nothing else, raising money, paying for 10 minutes a day for Amy Goodman, you know, doing her news wrap, even if we have to put it up as advertising, you know, get the public aware of what's really going on here. And it needs to happen soon.
So, I think there's a distinction between, you know, the local news media that's on the same channel versus the national media. But also, nobody really watches our local news.
Portland was the lead story. The protests in Portland were the lead story on BBC News.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. But I do think that that's national news. Our local news is very lazy and does not tell stories ever. But here is my position. I agree that there are some problems with the voting. I think it's not a coincidence that as soon as we got rid of the Voting Rights Act, that we get the most racist candidate in my lifetime. At the same time, I think that the way I look at it is like if somebody has a gun to your head, you can't spend time to try and get the bullet out. You got to run. And so I think that there are people that are spending time trying to get the bullet out or see if there is a bullet in there. But my group is trying to run because we have to prepare if there is a Donald Trump presidency, which I think is the most likely scenario, we are able to protect our community, and we only have 60-some days to do so. But I do appreciate and think that there are some problems in the voting system that have happened. I just think it's pretty unlikely that we're going to stop Donald Trump from being president. And if we spend all of our time right now trying to stop him from being president, then we're going to be not as prepared as we could be for when he does become president. So my group is pushing for specific policy changes in Portland to try and insulate ourselves. So we were putting pressure on to make sure that we would stay a sanctuary city. That was one of our main points. And then Ted Wheeler came out, and same with Chloe Udaly, saying that we will remain a sanctuary city. And I think that's the kind of stuff that our group is trying to push for. So we have specific policies that insulate ourselves from a possibly coming Donald Trump presidency.
Well, okay. Hey, that's wonderful. And I think so. But we do have a chance with the Electoral College. If we can get into the public awareness the fact that the election was stolen and that there's no paper trail and not allow any Electoral College votes based on e-voting without a solid paper trail. And the only way this is going to happen is if we can break that media barrier. And the only way I see that happening is if we're camped on Channel 8's doorstep every day, OPB, you know, sit in their parking lot and protest for a month. And
well,
make the national news, and the local news is going to have to follow.
Well,
it's just we've got to break that media.
Yeah, well, if that's something that organizers need to get involved in, it sounds like that's not something that Portland's resistance is taking on. Maybe you're suggesting that they should, and maybe they will take that into consideration. But also other people are free to organize in the things that they think. So thank you very much for putting it out there.
Okay. All right. Thanks for taking the call. Love
and the number is 503-231-8187. I'm speaking with Gregory McKelvey of the new group Portland's Resistance. Yeah, so talk a little bit. Did this, you know, you all have roots in various groups. Maybe talk a little bit about your own, how you came into it, and maybe some other people who you're working with, and like when this all kind of came into being.
So I think that one, people have to realize, especially the people that really hate me right now for what's going on, is that people were going to be in the streets regardless. We elected a candidate of chaos, and our group was formed during a protest that just organically already happened. So it's not like we're the ones putting people into the streets and inciting riots. These all were going to happen. And there was a day that we didn't have a protest. Protest still occurred. And then whatever happened that night, we were blamed for as well. But so my background, I was a political science and history major. I graduated from Oregon State. I grew up here in Portland. I run political campaigns, and that's what I did ever since I was in college. Two campaigns for the Benton County Board of Commissioners, and then that was successful. And then I just ran a campaign just now. For State Senate District 21, James Offsing's campaign, which we lost. But so I was a political, organizer. I've also worked as an advisor, advising people like even Bernie Sanders to Julian Bell, and different progressive candidates that have run. And then from working on the Bernie Sanders campaign and having connections to local Black Lives Matter movements, they brought me on to like do a lot of speaking and such. And that's kind of where I started doing public speaking. And ever since then, I've had, you know, more of a following. And I was also elected as a delegate to the DNC, where I helped lead the walkout on Hillary Clinton. So that's a little bit of my background. I work with Bernie PDX, Portland Tenants United, and have done a lot of work with Don't Shoot Portland as well.
Well, that's amazing. I didn't know that piece about leading the walkout. That's awesome. That's direct action in a really interesting
situation. I think that's the reason why we got a Donald Trump presidency, is because the DNC conspired against Bernie Sanders, and I think Bernie Sanders would have beat Donald Trump.
That's one. There's so many different ways of doing a post-mortem on this terrible election. And yeah, there's a lot of people who are saying that. Of course, always hard to know, but certainly the combination of Clinton's weaknesses, the DNC's machinations, and the end of the Voting Rights Act, and all the things that Greg Palast brings up and others bring up about the way that that elections can be swung by, you know, just implemented strategies of taking people off the voter rolls and such things. Anyway, that's for another time. So where are things going? So this seems like it's really, I was at the city hall on, was it Friday evening, and kind of chaotic. It was a little big, too big a crowd and difficult space, but it seems like people got into different quadrants, groups, and they're different from where they are in the city. I thought that was a really good, you know, place. I've always been into place-based organizing. I thought that your words and Adrian's words and your other fellow organizers were all just spot on. I was telling people, this isn't just like a compliment. This is just, you know, it's always really good to hear just people being really on point and saying things that are really, have the potential for resonating with lots of people and are like really just bringing things into focus. So anyway, I thought I was really pleased to see that. So where are things going with your group?
So, you know, I viewed that past week of when there were already going to be protests in the street. The reason that we got involved is because a lot of these people are new to activism and protesting. And I don't think a lot of people understand how dangerous it is, not just getting beat by the cops out there, but now every single person that got arrested is getting death threats for being a part of the riot. Every single person, because the Oregonian decided to publish every single person's picture and name, which is disgusting.
That's unusual, isn't
and
it?
If any of them, you know, actually someone's house was actually already broken into, and if any of them, you know, are injured, I really do blame the Oregonian for that. But And not one of them was arrested for a crime of vandalism or anything like that. They were all arrested for peacefully protesting, and that's why none of the charges are going to stick, because there's no evidence of anything, because they didn't do anything wrong other than use their First Amendment right to push for progress. But what I view that period as last week is kind of a charging, you know, and we're not at 100% yet. We need to charge a little bit more. But once we do that, we need to direct that energy towards something positive, which I view as policy changes in our community. We need to pick up the slack on climate change. We don't know if the EPA is really going to exist. Coal to clean was a nice step, but it still allows us to rely on natural gas, which sounds good, but it's not. That's the stuff that's flowing through the Dakota pipeline if it goes through, and it's a fossil fuel.
No, that's tar sands oil.
Sure, yeah, but this is the kind of stuff that goes through pipelines. It's a fossil fuel, you know, natural gas. It sounds good, but it's a fossil fuel. And I think we need to end the fossil fuel industry. And coal to clean still allows us to rely a lot on natural gas. So the states need to pick up the slack on that, as well as healthcare. I think we need single payer healthcare. And that's something that we can do at the state level. There has been bills that have been introduced in the past, and I think we need to support those. And then also we need to end the racial disparity in policing in our city and in our state. 64% of the people that are designated basically for special surveillance put on the gang enforcement task list are black. Just black. And most of those people are put on there for the clothing or the jewelry that they wear. And the least common reason to be put on that list is for being a self-describing gang member. So where this goes from here is towards actual policy changes. We've charged up a very big movement. Now we need to train, educate, do forums, that kind of stuff, so we can get people mobilized to join the groups that are working on this kind of stuff already, and just kind of be a hub to get people to know where to go and to learn for all these new young activists. And especially like these high school kids that are walking out, we need to plug them in.
So we're going to go to Marcos in a second, if he's still on the line. But first, I just got to say what's coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, a rare interview with Angela Davis from 1972, eerily reminiscent of today's political landscape. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, as usual. And at 11, Chris Siegel hosts The Food Show and will tell us how the sharing economy has come to the kitchen, plus how Donald Trump's presidency will affect food policy. And as always, thank all you KBOO members for your oh-so-generous support. If you're not a current member, you can always become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. This is our contribution to the Portland Resistance, or mine anyway. I'll speak for my own show, but I think KBOO certainly has the spirit of community resilience, community resistance, which is kind of, a lot of people are talking about how to sort of focus on local and state responses to the emergency we're in. Let's go to Marcos, though. Are you still on?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
I'd just like to list a few points and then get into a bit of a discussion if we can. One thing is peaceful protests encourage large crowds. They encourage families. They encourage people that don't want to be involved in a violent event but do want to express themselves politically. Violent protests, by nature, are pretty small because they only get people that are ready to be in a dangerous situation. So you're going to get a much smaller crowd. The presence of peacekeepers essentially supports the democratic process. It prevents a handful of people from hijacking a protest of thousands of people and redefining that protest as a quote-unquote violent protest. There weren't 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 violent people on the streets. There were about half a couple of dozen of people that were involved in breaking windows and breaking windshields. They effectively, that half a dozen or a dozen or a couple of dozen, however many you want to say, they effectively hijacked the protest and redefined the nature of the protest into a quote-unquote riot, which then enabled the city to send in riot cops.
Okay, get on to your second point, because if you keep going, you'll take the rest of the 15 minutes.
I'll just say that it was a peaceful protest without any police supervision, and the decision not to have peacekeepers...
Right, we got that. Go ahead. It's just that there's other callers, and then time is ticking away.
Can I just address that? I'm not sure what the media narrative right now is, but this type of thing that you're talking about only happened at one of our protests, which was the night that the police declared it a riot. They were also
successful redefining the protest henceforth. And that's why hundreds of people got arrested. I'm sorry, that's why dozens of people got arrested.
Hundreds.
That's why all the riot cops showed up, whereas previously they weren't there at all. The city had shown historical restraint in allowing the protest to be unpoliced on Wednesday night and unpoliced on Thursday up until the trashing. And the only reason the trashing happened was because you guys made a deliberate decision not to have peacekeepers, which would have basically defended the democratic process. This is what democracy looks like, means that the protest has a right to define its nature, its own nature, and to have a tiny minority of people create that definition. If they want to create that definition, let them do their diversity of tactics on their own and not redefine the mission of thousands of people.
So,
okay.
I don't have much disagreement with anything that you've said, but what I will say is that these people are smashing with bats and such, and this all happened. We showed up. This is when the protest was already going on. So, you know, it's really hard on the fly.
Because there were no peacekeepers. You made a decision not to have peacekeepers. That created a vacuum in which a half a dozen or a couple of dozen people could exploit that vacuum. That's irresponsible.
Okay, I think we need to
define. It's a political mistake.
Okay. Listen. We got other callers. I think this is an important discussion.
Thank you for promoting the discussion. Thank you.
Okay.
One, we didn't have the capacity to just have a bunch of peacekeepers for 4,000 people. And also, my number one worry was not, you know, the narrative or the. Or the property, first and foremost, is always going to be personal safety. And I didn't have the ability at that moment to direct people to physically intervene with people with baseball bats. And I feel like I understand the frustration there, but I think it would have been more irresponsible for me to get a group of inexperienced people and then try to tell them in a matter of minutes how to intervene with people with baseball bats. And I think that would have been much more irresponsible.
Okay, well, Marcos raises an important question, and there could well be, obviously there are, strategic, tactical, political differences.
I would argue, though, we've taken our narrative back. I think, you know, every single one of those people being having their charges dropped, plus the events that we've held since then, we are learning. You know, I've been doing marches here in Portland for years, but never with 4,000 people. So we are learning, we're adapting, we're getting better at it, and I encourage people to come see to the actions that we're doing now. Did you see the need for peacekeepers when you were there on Friday?
Well, I didn't go on the march afterwards.
Yeah.
So I remember doing those some of those 4-hour don't shoot marches, and I'm just getting too old for it.
Yeah, me too.
That's lame, I know, but I didn't. But no, so I can't speak to that. But anyway, so this is an alive discussion. This is an emerging thing. It's good to have these conversations. I hope Marcos will get involved in because it seems like this Portland's Resistance seems to be the only, you know, organization that is claiming the ground of some sort of, if not mass movement, at least, you know, trying to, as I said, bring together, you know, whether or not those groups do want to come together because our historical, you know, ideological and political differences. Before you respond to that, how you see yourself, your group addressing some of these things, let's go to our next call. Nathan, are you still there? Perhaps not.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey. Yeah, I'm here, and I'm sort of, I guess you would say, a voice of opposition. I actually voted for Trump, but I guess I identify as a what they call a cisgendered white male conservative, but I'm really not all that conservative. And I was curious because there has been a lot of outcry on social media with people talking about wanting to spill the blood of Trump and his supporters and stuff like that, much like there was with Obama and stuff like that, which I do not support that, you know, either.
I haven't heard that personally. Have you heard that, Greg?
Well, you broke the number one rule, which is don't read the comments.
No, I'm not talking about the comments. I'm talking about just all the Twitter feeds and stuff like that. There was just all kinds of outcries of all this stuff. And like I said, I don't support either one of them. I didn't support the conservatives that, you know, said that Obama should have been shot. That bothered me deeply. Like I said, I don't really identify as a true conservative because I'm for gay marriage. I'm for
Okay, so what's your question? We only have 5 minutes left. What's your question?
What my question is coming from my background, I am actually calling to reach out to talk to you and see about the different ideological perspectives that we come from, one of them being the racial inequality in America. I view a little bit different, but then again, I come from a very rural town in Georgia, or a rural suburb of Atlanta, where I was profiled by police just for my last name. It wasn't the color of my skin, it was my last name, and also my family history mirrors that a lot of minorities. And there are a lot of us out there that have that, and honestly, I don't see why we're fighting each other based on some urban versus rural stuff that the media keeps propagating in the mainstream media. And I would like to reach out and start a dialogue of how many things we actually have in common and see where our common ground is.
Okay, Greg?
So I think there is a big struggle also with economics, that there's many forms of privilege, and some of that has to do with economics, but none go higher than the privilege of white privilege. And you know, I'm not specifically towards this caller, but I'm just really sick of white cisgendered men telling black people how they should feel about race, to say that, you know, it's made up or it's a construct. We didn't make it up. To me, it's like if I ask you, let's go out tonight, but please let me pick your outfit. Please let me pick your outfit. And you don't want me to pick your outfit, but I pick it anyway. And then we go. You come out the closet and I'm dressed in the best clothes ever and you're dressed in rags. And then you say, why'd you dress me in this? And you're dressed super well. And I say, well, it doesn't matter what you're wearing. It's what's on the inside. Well, then why did you set it up this way? And so when you say things like, you know, race is just not real or something like that, what you're saying is you don't see me, because I didn't choose to have to be put into a society where black lives are undervalued. And it's not fun. It's not fun to be a victim. And it takes a lot to come out and say that you're a victim. But I just want to say, you know, our system is supposed to be set up where we can have political differences. And myself, you know, our founding fathers all had extreme political differences, and some of them hated each other, but they created a system where we're supposed to have political dialogue and still move our country forward. And I think we've been infiltrated so much by money and politics and special interests that conversation now doesn't exist in the way that it's supposed to, especially the way that our media is polarized. If I want to, I can find a bubble and create myself a bubble where I'm only seeing media that supports my narrative. So I do encourage having conversations with Trump supporters, but there are some scary ones out there, as the ones that are giving me death threats every single day.
Okay, well, thank you for calling, Nathan. We only got like 2 minutes left. Jane, are you still there? Just if you have a real quick comment or question.
Yes, I do. Thank you for everything you're doing and helping move. Speaking of infiltration, do you think at all that people were provocateurs doing all the damage?
Okay, thank you for that. The connection wasn't that good, but I think we got the question.
Okay, so I think, you know, Martin Luther King said a riot is the language of the unheard. I don't think they were provocateurs. I don't think that they were plants or anything like that. I think they're people that feel unheard and were expressing that frustration in that way. And what I can do is help try and lead by example and maybe try and channel that frustration towards policy differences rather than destruction. But at the same time, it's not my job to censor anybody else's activism, only to lead by example.
So, again, we only have 2 minutes left. So, you know, if this thing is going to become what I think you want it to be, a political movement that actually has a real effect on the landscape here in Portland and Oregon, and actually not just influences the existing politicians, but actually creates, you know, some form of local political structure that's perhaps parallel to and has the capability of maybe even taking over to some extent the existing political structure. That's a long discussion we can't get into. So how do people plug in? There's, I guess, already a Northeast chapter. I'd like to, maybe get involved in Southeast Portland Resist. Is that something you see the way it's going to go? People actually plug in through where they live? Or
yeah, so what people are doing is creating their own chapters just to kind of, it's mostly not so they can organize their own stuff, but they can and should, but so that they can communicate as a group, as a community, because moving forward, we have safety concerns. So making sure you build community, have safe houses for these people that are having their lives threatened. But if you want to plug in with anything, the website is pdxresistance.org. There's a volunteer form. I encourage people to sign up to volunteer. We have different committees that you can select what committee you would want to be on. The donation form is there too if you want to contribute to our GoFundMe. Our mission statement is on there, and also you can stay on there for events. There's also a high school walkout going on Monday. So anybody that can support that. The link for the GoFundMe is on our website, pdxresistance.org. I don't know the specific GoFundMe link, but on pdxresistance.org,
okay,
the link is there.
We got to run. We're out of time. Gregory McKelvey, Portland's Resistance, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Aftermath, part of the Brown Paper series produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs November 28th at 7 p.m. at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. In Mary Burrell's 1919 one-act, John Thornton, a young black soldier who has served his country in World War I, comes home to rural South Carolina. His homecoming is disrupted when he learns that someone close to him has been lynched by a white mob. Again, that's Aftermath, produced by Triangle Productions, November 28th at 7 p.m. at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of